Welcome to Took Talk, a video podcast by the band Took, and brought to you by Black Frog Media. We chat with the best in the music industry from yesterday and today, with a focus on the good old days of Canadian rock. This episode originally streamed live on Tuesday, June 1st, 2021 on Facebook Live. Now, here are your hosts, Todd, Brent, Shane, Corey, and Darren.
Yeah, Jets.
I just saw this sitting here, so I thought I should hold it up.
Why not?
In celebration of your jersey.
Yeah, and Brent's running a little bit late.
Brent's running
he
late,
probably so. Would have been sporting something as well. So
playing the part of Brent Fitz will be this hard rubber.
are the Jets still in it?
It might have more interesting things to say. I'm just kidding.
Are the Jets still in it?
They're still in it. That's pretty exciting. And the game is tomorrow, right?
First game against Montreal after the big game last night. So I'm sure, anybody in Canada, we saw that was happening. But so Jets are going to the next round versus the Habs. So
exciting stuff.
Who's still all left? I mean, that's a long question.
Well, Vegas and Avalanche. How about that game the other night?
That Winnipeg boy is rough kid.
So it's just one game been played in that series?
In Colorado, Vegas, yeah.
Yeah, yes. That's the next one's tomorrow.
It wasn't a pretty one.
But it was a blowout, right?
But it was hockey.
Oh, yeah. Vegas got slammed.
Like, what was it? Eight, seven, one, something
like that?
Yeah,
was it that bad?
Yeah, well.
I stopped paying attention at 4.
The match penalty didn't help, though, so,
I know, that was brutal. Yeah, mm-hmm. What do you do?
But,
pull some guy's hair out, right?
It's hockey, baby. It's hockey.
The hair. I didn't know pulling hair was a part of hockey.
Gladiator-style hockey.
It is. And, one of our guests we're talking has a tie to Newfoundland, and I have a tie to Newfoundland today, so I wanted to get your opinion on this because it's a Canadian bet here, and now that Montreal, I've got a friend out in Newfoundland, Habs fan his entire life.
Sure.
Obviously, and I wish Brent was here because he'd, side
by
with me on this one.
Means the Montreal Canadiens.
The Montreal Canadiens, yeah.
Yeah.
So we've got a friendly bet. We're trying to think of something that we can kind of wager to go city versus city here and determine what the outcome is. So, it's not going to be a financial thing, but it's got to be some sort of embarrassing thing. So I just want to see if anybody threw up in the comments if they could recommend anything that might be good,
because if somebody loses, they have to like do something embarrassing.
Yeah, like he has to run into the ocean naked with a Jets jersey on or something. I don't know. Like,
well, it's technically not naked.
I guess, or I don't know, Montreal Canadiens speedo. I don't know, something.
Yeah, something like that.
That'd be good.
But are you prepared? Are you prepared to do the same?
I'm confident. I'm confident.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Well, there's no oceans around Winnipeg, though. That's the problem.
Yeah. Lots of lakes, though.
And probably a hell of a lot colder.
Yeah. Well, actually, the weather's been pretty good here, so we'll see. I mean, it's how are you guys been doing? We missed last week. I mean, everybody was busy. Yeah.
Sidetracked. Yeah.
What's been happening?
How was it by yourself then, Darren? I just assumed you were sitting on your way.
I did. Yeah. Nobody
talking to people.
Yeah, it was. I just re-recorded an hour of just sitting here, waiting for you guys to join in.
Just cutting different reactions from us when you're talking about stuff, and then just kind of splice in like weird reactions.
No, we just did like one of those greatest hits, shows where we pull like little clips of all the other previous episodes,
A clip show, as they call those. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was it was good. I mean, anyway, we have some nice weather here, and finally, so Corey can't go anywhere. Off. Our restrictions are still in place.
That's right. Corey was roaming the deserts of
Utah,
and you went into Colorado or something, didn't you?
We went all the way to Denver. Actually, spent 3 days with Nigel. Remember Nigel from a couple weeks back?
Sure, yeah. Wow.
Nigel Green was one of our Took Talk guests, and we stayed at his place for 3 days and did a little hiking around.
He wasn't aware of it. He was away, but
yeah, we broke into his house. We knew he wasn't going to be there.
That'd be way more rock and roll.
Yeah, and then we came back through Telluride. Do you know about Telluride, Colorado?
I've heard of it.
Ski resort, right?
I don't know much about it.
It's a ski resort?
It is, but it used to be a mining town that they reinvented into a ski resort. And
cool.
My friend Derek Frank, the bass player that plays with me in Shania's band, he was always posting pictures from there. I'm like, I got to check this place out. So Jody and I spent a couple nights there and did a lot of hiking around there. Saw a lot of waterfalls, and we saw some rattlesnakes and some cool birds and a lot of – it's closest thing to actually Switzerland or, like, say, Banff or something.
Sure.
That I've seen in the U.S. other than, you know, Alaska or somewhere like that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And then we came back through Utah. We stopped in Capitol Reef National Park and Canyonlands National Park. I think Canyonlands National Park was where Thelma and Louise drove over the cliff at the end.
Right. Brent Fitz is here. He's right over
Brent
there.
Fitz.
Brent Point. Fitz. In the house. Dude, that was coming.
Made it. Yeah, well done. Made it. Yeah. Oh, we missed you at the intro. We had a big Jets thing going there, yeah.
Yeah. You're late. You're too late for that.
Very late.
We're already past that Jets thing. We're talking about Utah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how was that drive back? Because I was driving from California to Vegas, and I looked, and it was like kind of smooth sailing, but the other way going from Nevada into California was
brutal. Yeah, so it was a seamless trip until we hit outside of Vegas, where we hit a bottleneck, and everybody was parked basically on the 15 freeway going south at Baker. There was a semi trailer truck that had completely burned, and apparently there was explosives in the back of it or something that still weren't ignited or something. So they basically diverted three lanes of highway traffic through the town of Baker in a single lane. Wow, and I tell you, we went 6 miles in probably 2 hours.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's what it looked like. It looked like basically everybody was just parked on the I-15. And, just chilling. Yep.
How was your charge at that point?
It was getting very low. It was like 40 miles or something. So I knew we were going to make it, but if we were going to be parked on the freeway for too long, you know what, because it was 108 on outside. So we definitely needed AC and whatnot. We would have been in trouble. And there were a lot of people giving fingers and stuff. Because people were driving on the shoulders, right? And so the trucks would turn into the shoulder lane, and then they'd start driving in the ditch, and and then somebody got in an accident there, so that even caused more problems because it was a nightmare.
You gotta love those guys that just try to go around because they think that the other people in front of them are just sitting there because they want to.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Like we have nothing to do but just sit there. You go on ahead. Just
we're here to hold you up.
Yeah.
Brent, how you doing?
Oh, Brent? Sorry, I was on mute. I loved all the variables of being at home. I hear four dogs barking, and I'm like, I'm not going to let you guys deal with my four dogs in the background. But it's so nice to be home after gone for a week. But yes, my dogs are outside barking. I'm good. I'm ready for hockey. I've been watching, and I was in LA, as was Todd, last week when the Jets clinched that overtime. So felt pretty good, but I didn't have a lot of people to celebrate with. Well, none of us do because we're all obligated to. Well, you, Darren, can't go to your neighbor's house to say, "Hey, how about that Jet game?" Right? It's totally ridiculous.
I know.
You still can't even go out.
They just extended it till June 15th again. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Today is the first day. Today's the first day of no masks in Nevada, or at least Las Vegas. Right? Right, Fitz?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I see that they're trying to do something because now, and then it always comes back to hockey. Toronto, obviously, last night, Montreal, or two nights before, had fans in the crowd. You guys are familiar with that because the States, you know, all the teams down there have been doing that for a while now. Toronto had, I guess, some fans. They sold some tickets. Prices were crazy. And then they invited 500 frontline healthcare workers for free to come to the game.
Cool.
Yeah, and my son said, he goes, the reason they did that was because they knew that they were going to choke.
Come on. Oh, wow.
That was a good game, yeah. So
I was reading, they're maybe going to talking about opening up on the 21st.
Possibly here?
Opening the border, yeah.
Oh.
They're going to reassess.
U.S.-Canada border?
So, yeah.
It'd be nice because I haven't seen my family in 15, 16 months now. I don't even know.
It'd be great if they did that.
Yeah.
I know they're talking because they're talking about things like Calgary Stampede, you know, going ahead, obviously a scaled down version, a lot of other things that are trying to, but I think it's really important because, I mean, I just don't think you can go any longer. I mean, some things are just not going to reopen if they don't do something quick. So, yeah.
Well, I think the thing is if, they're projecting to have like 75% of the population vaxxed by then. So if that happens, then they can open it up. But we'll see, I guess.
And we're still backed up. I mean, I haven't even had my first shot. I'm still waiting because I'm booked for the 11th of June, I think. Yeah. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, there you go.
So, but I mean,
you're just a little bit behind, but it's going to happen quicker than we think.
Yeah.
It's starting
just to make sense of this hockey and fans thing. So, okay, the Jets and Habs series coming up starting tomorrow, there will be no fans in Winnipeg, correct?
You know what? Until tomorrow, I won't say for sure, because I saw something online saying that if you have had, if you're fully vaccinated and meet criteria, they may be allowing a certain number of people in. I don't know. I mean,
how much are those tickets going to be?
Yeah,
exactly. A very limited number.
Well, I think it's also going to be an unfair advantage because if you're, you know as well as anybody, I mean, if you're playing to fans, it's obviously, a bigger rush than if you're just playing to an empty arena. So there is going to be that advantage because Montreal's already doing it, right? So,
I've played to a lot of empty arenas in my life. And I will again.
So, yeah. So you can, yeah, exactly. But which do you prefer,
Oh,
okay, I see. And if Jets, let's even go further ahead. The next series, the team that wins from the Jets and Habs, and of course we are wishing for the Jets to win, but going down to the next round would be in the States. So if there's a crowd, let's say in Vegas or Colorado, which has already, I think the last night's game had 12,000 people. And if the Jets are coming from an empty arena vibe, then that's going to be
Can you imagine? They would just be like
a serious disadvantage for sure.
Totally. Well, you can tell. I mean, when they did this at the beginning of the year, I remember seeing these guys talk about it and they said, well, whatever, we'll play the season as is and we'll worry about the playoffs because I'm sure by then this will all be figured out. Well, here we are, like you said. I mean, borders are still closed. Don't even know. Some people aren't even vaccinated. Here we are right in the thick of it. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure they got to either do something quick because I saw a Boston game the other day, 17,000 people or something there. I mean, it's crazy. Yeah. I mean,
yeah, everything's returning to normal here.
Okay, so really quick, it is Morris Lukowich, the greatest, my favorite Winnipeg Jet from the golden era. It's his birthday today, so we got to wish him
happy birthday.
There you go.
My brother and his wife, they officially got married together today.
There you go. Wow.
They've been together 20 years, so I said, call me if you need any advice on your wedding night, Twenty years later, they decided to make it official.
Did they go downtown like Justice of the Peace, kind of like a little?
I think so. Yeah, they wanted to come to Vegas and do a bunch of stuff, but they've been putting it off for quite a while. So because of this, it's the
best time to have a wedding though, because when you don't invite somebody, you can say COVID.
It's COVID.
Well, you invite everybody, and then nobody comes, but everybody sends you money.
That's right.
There you go.
Sorry you couldn't make it, but we are still accepting presentation.
Exactly.
Well, they've been happily unmarried forever, though, right? So, congratulations to them.
But they've been together a long time.
Which brother is that?
John. My brother John. He's in Toronto.
We got to get John on the show.
I talked to those guys the other day, not that long ago, so we'll talk about that later.
Wink.
Okay, wink.
It's impossible getting I don't know. It's anybody who's ever been a tour manager in their life, I always have great sympathy for them because I can't imagine trying to corral anybody together. The fact that we get together every Tuesday like this is shocking enough. Yeah, but these gentlemen here are a little bit more reliable in that category. Most musicians kind of come with a certain degree of we're about to talk to two, by the way. Just kidding. Most musicians are loose cannons at best. I'm just kidding. I love these guys. Should we bring them on?
Yeah, we might as well. Yeah, we've been going for 15 minutes here. This is we're making up for a week that we missed. So yeah, it's okay.
That's right. That's exactly. Plus, so, I've been around for a couple weeks, so it's good to be here.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, because you just kind of jumped in.
Didn't even notice. Wow.
No, we got to hear from everybody else.
I know. Yeah. Other people were allowed to talk.
I didn't even know Corey had a mic on there.
My voice is still sore from talking. Yeah.
But anyways, we love hearing your voice. So let's hear it now. Introduce these fine gentlemen that we're waiting on.
I've known these guys a long time. Back in the day, you'd cross the country 1,000 times. I know Fitz has done some interactions with these characters as well. Ken played in Winnipeg's legendary The Watchmen. Mm-hmm. And he was also in Ian Thornley's Thornley. He's done a million things. He's an amazing solo artist. He does his own thing. And then Mike Turner, I've known since way back in when he was an Our Lady Peace. And now he's been playing in a super group with Jeff Burrows from The Tea Party, Edwin from the other three word band, I'm the Earth. And he's an amazing producer and songwriter and all that kind of stuff. And they have a new project to talk about. So, ladies and gentlemen, Ken Tizard and Mike Turner.
Hey, hey, hey.
Hello. Woo-hoo.
Hey, guys.
A little bit smaller.
I didn't get into your stats as far as, like, you know, height, weight, likes, dislikes.
Oh.
Eye color?
Hello. Eye color. Yeah.
I don't know. Is that what people are looking for nowadays? I can't tell anymore.
I'm not sure what your guys' status is. I'm just trying to make sure you get as much, you know, it's basically like a podcast / Tinder, really, is what I'm trying to work up here.
Oh, cool. Well, yeah.
I haven't been late in a while.
Swipe.
Yeah. You'll be disappointed. Trust me. Every time you swipe, you just get another guy from two.
His phone is ringing.
Somebody's phone is buzzing.
It's me. Sorry.
Not mine. I was just checking there.
How you guys doing, man? It's so good to see you.
It's Mike? Just nice to interact with any human.
I know, right? Yeah. I get the impression that you guys, it's same as me in this room where your guitars are. This is basically where I've been for a year and a half and just some. Sometimes I go to my house and spend time with my family, but most of the time I'm just kind of in here. Yeah.
Well, I mean, originally, you see where that 78 P bass is over there?
Can I have that, by the way?
What's that?
Can I have that?
Don't no, bass. Not a chance. I managed to get that one from Art Bergman's bass player back in the back ages ago. That's the only bass I've kept forever. But right where that is placed used to be my bed, and my daughter Cassidy was born right about where, you know, if you were to pluck maybe an E flat on the that would be about the height and where she was actually born into the world.
What?
So wow. It's amazing that these environments that we have at home have become our workplaces. As musicians, we all kind of have places. I mean, Mike's got, you know, massive studios that he works out of, and you guys all know that too. But everybody has their little home world, but they've become so important this last couple of years. It's amazing.
Well, and with the technologies growing and all that kind of stuff, where you can do this stuff at home, where you don't necessarily have to go to a big studio, but I'm glad Mike has the option to do so.
Wait, you remember in the 90s, you know, it was like, we've got some studio time. We have to do it from midnight till 5 a.m. If we're really lucky, we'll get three songs. And then we've got to save up our pennies. Oh, shit. Does anyone have tape?
Yeah.
Can we get some used tape? Now it's, you know. There's better recording in my phone
than
Kurt OLP record on.
Yeah. That is actually absolutely 100% true. Was that that just come in there? The real band that has the room, they're going to be out from like midnight. Just come in directly after and sneak in and sort of.
It was a dark time.
All the early Age of Electric stuff was all done like that.
The first OLP demos. The worst of it was the last set that we did. Our friend DJ Williams had us in Montreal doing a few shows, just in like shitty little pubs.
As you do, play
the show at the pub, drive back to Toronto, mix a song, drive back to Montreal for the next one. It's like, shouldn't we be scheduling a period in there that involves a bed? But you know, when you're a kid, you're just like, no, I'm good. I'm only been up for 3 days. I'm good for another hour.
Yeah, I could sleep while somebody else is driving back to Montreal. Yeah.
The majority of the early Watchmen demos, I mean, the official demos that got sent to the label were a little different, but the writing demos that we did, I would say that, you know, in my recollection, the majority of those first three records were all done on there was a big silver boom box that sat in the corner of our jam space.
You had to learn the spot.
And you'd put a cassette in and you'd just press record and we'd jam the song and then one person would get to take it home and listen to it. And that was how the songs evolved. That was our early recording, was still just on a friggin' old boombox.
The same. It was only when we started to semi-pro things. But like I was saying, you had to learn where was the spot in the room that worked. Yeah. Oh, too much drums, too much bass.
Yeah.
Well, wait. That's the spot. Leave it there. And it would be like sort of enshrined to capture whatever idea you came up with. Because we, in the early days, we wrote very much, trying to catch lightning in a bottle. Magic happens.
Yeah.
Quickly record it, you know, then craft it. And,
totally.
And having the magic boombox position, that was everything.
That's really not that much. They will never know the struggle.
It's really not that much different than, like, you know, when you're placing the phone just to get an arrangement or whatever, you're jamming with your friends. It's a similar idea for kids that don't know what a boombox is.
But, yeah. Exactly.
We're going to translate this for the youngins.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you don't know what a boombox is, you really should. Look it up. Good times.
Everything old is coming new again.
Everything old's becoming new. Let's go backwards first, I think, because I wanted to address the fact that Ken is originally from Newfoundland.
Yeah.
Newfoundland.
And yeah, exactly. Newfoundland.
Land.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, did you catch the shout out to your hometown in the theme song?
I did. Yeah. I did. I always catch any sort of Newfoundland reference. It's good.
There you go. Yeah.
So yeah. At what point did you make your way west? How did you get connected to the band? Was it the Watchmen that took you away? No. How did this all come about?
Do you remember Jody Mitchell used to work as an A&R guy at EMI?
Yes, I do, actually.
Yeah. So I met Jody at one of the early COCA conferences in Canada. I was 17 in Newfoundland, and I actually...
You were 17 in Newfoundland, so you were actually 15?
Exactly.
17 and a half.
17 and a half.
And I said, this is my story. I'm a bass player. I want to play music. And he said, you've got to get off this rock. Mm. And, I 6 months later, I bought a plane ticket to Toronto, and I just went up and I started telemarketing and beating my way through every band on Queen Street. Eventually ran into Jake Gold, who was managing this band from Winnipeg. And one day he saw me on a morning TV show I was doing. And he asked me if I would be interested in joining a band that he has from Winnipeg. And I said, no, absolutely not. I just came from Newfoundland to Toronto. there's no way I'm moving to fucking Winnipeg. But he offered to fly me out for a weekend and meet the guys. And something I hadn't realized that was happening was that in Toronto, I was playing with a lot of, for lack of a better term, Humber grads. And all these Humber musicians in Toronto, they all had very different work attitudes. And I came from Newfoundland playing punk rock, where I grew up with a bunch of friends who were playing music because we were friends and we skateboarded together and we did all this shit and we created music we wanted to. And all of a sudden it was all... There was a lot of hired guns and stuff, and I'd kind of gotten used to it in Toronto, but the weekend that I flew out to meet the Watchmen, when I came home, I just kind of went, shit, that was like playing with friends from back home again. And then I got the call the next morning that if I wanted the gig, I could take it. So I decided, the only one thing was I wasn't going to move to Winnipeg because I just getting settled into Toronto. But yeah, that's sort of the story there. You know, I just felt really great with those guys. It was a weird thing.
Wait a second. So Jake saw you on TV. Jake Gold saw you on television. Well, why were you on television? Was this like America's Most Wanted or what? Yeah.
I had just come back from a 5 week tour of Russia with a band called Growl. In 1992, we went over. We arrived in Moscow the day that the White House over there was bombed and there was a countrywide shutdown.
Why did you bomb their White House?
Let's not go there. Anyway, so I did this crazy
17 tour. You're 17? This is like, you're not even 18?
No, at this point here, I was just 19. Yeah. And I was in Toronto.
That's young. That's some serious shit for someone who's 19.
Now, for Russia, we got adopted by like the main biker gang over there because we got ripped off at our first show. And for the 6 weeks we were there, every train we got off, there was a biker waiting to take us to our next stop. Yeah. And whenever we had nights off, we had to go to Sexton Fawns and play there for them. So that was how we kind of survived over there.
Was Growl from Toronto?
Growl was a Toronto folk rock band that had Peter and Mark Kesper, the guy who now owns Capsule Music.
Love those guys.
Wow.
Most of what's behind me came from them.
I bet it did. Right? Yeah, they've got Peter's got amazing stuff.
Are you ever going to give it back, Mike? That's really cool.
So, Ken, sorry.
They went to Russia. You came from St. John's? Unloaded all that gear.
Okay.
Yeah, so I came back from Russia, and because we had just toured Russia, City TV was like, hey, why don't you guys come on and play? So I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning and went and did City TV and then went to my, at the time, day job, the only job that I ever had. Like, I came to Toronto, did a bunch of telemarketing shit, and then there was a receptionist job at Music Express magazine, which you might all remember from the 80s and 90s. There was like Army, Rolling Stone, Spin, and then Music Express.
Of course.
They needed a receptionist. And I went and I, you know, sort of sat down and chatted, and I ended up getting the job. But within 6 months, I had wormed my way into the photography department. And I, as the photo editor was leaving, I took the position.
Nice.
So I was then setting up all these, you know, this young Newfoundlander in Toronto, I'm setting up photo shoots with like Herb Ritz shooting REM, Annie Leibovitz shooting Annie Lennox, U2. Wow. It was just wild. Yeah. And I was just like this kid. And I did that for a few years, but that was where I met Jake. We shared office space. And the day that I played this show, because I was playing music 5-6 nights a week and working in the day. And the day that I got back from Russia, I played the show and then I went back to my day job. And that's when Jake saw me and said, I thought you were a photographer. And I said, no, I really want to be a bass player. I'm a musician. That's what I am. I'm just doing this job because it's a job and it's cool. And he said, well, I got
a
band.
You wanted to be a bass player or a musician, let's be honest.
Or, yeah, whichever paid more. Yeah, yeah.
Just kidding. As a guy who plays bass for a living.
But that's the story there on how I ended off getting with the Watchmen.
Wow, that's so crazy. In all the years that I've known you, I don't think I ever pieced together that you were from back east. I assumed you were just part of that Winnipeg crew.
No, I went out and I met them and I met Danny's mom and I moved in and basically lived with Danny's mom for the first year the band was, you know, doing stuff. And then we went on the road for 20 years.
Nice. I would love to hear more about your telemarketing. Like, how did that happen? What did you have to do? And how did you feel at the end of your day?
Is there a script involved?
There's script. They were all for Toronto magazine newspapers. So it was the Toronto Sun, the Toronto Star. I would go in. They would pay you like by the week, so you could go in and work 3 days, get a check, and then never go back. So whenever I was really broke, the first 2 months I was in Toronto, I'd just call up the Star and say, I'm looking for a job as a telemarketer. You go in, they give you a phone, you're in a room, there's a script, and they give you a bunch of numbers, and you call, and you say, hey, you just canceled your service. I'm wondering if I can help. And whatever that person says, you follow the script, and by the end of the day, you've been told to fuck off like 500 times.
Oh, jeez.
What was the conversion rate on that?
I'm not coming back. Give me my check, and I'd cash my check, and I'd try and pay my rent, and then I'd get broke again and have to go do it again.
Oh, no.
Oh, man.
I'm curious to know what it was like as a kid in St. John's growing up. You said you were skateboarding, punk rock, so Sex Pistols. Like, was there folk music you were listening to, like your parents? Or what?
There was a ton of diddly-dee music, you know, as we call it, you know, the fiddles and buttons, accordions.
Yeah.
And there was a great folk scene. But, okay, so at about 12 or 13 years old, I found myself in downtown St. John's hanging out with these people that were, you know, we were kind of became this small punk scene. And over the course of that first year that we were down there, we went from about 20 of us who played music and skateboarded together to about 70 punk rockers that hung out on Atlantic Place steps every day, every single day after school. That's where we were. And we hung out there till dinner time. And on the weekends, we were there all the time. And there was anywhere between 30 and 80 of us there at a time. And there was a few bands in Newfoundland. There was Schizoid and Tough Justice and Public Enemy and Wofford, and a few others. And these four bands would do shows all year. And we'd get up to 200-300 kids out to these shows. And we'd pool all the money. And I think it was Bob Armstrong who started a company called DUPP. You got to remember, we were all between 13 and 17. And DUPP stood for Dead Upturned Puppy Productions. And DUPP once a year would take all the collective money from these bands, and we would bring in a band, like we brought in SNFU, DOA, Deja Voodoo. So once a year, we'd get to see these crazy bands.
Sure, yeah.
And it actually got to a point where the promoters kind of caught on, because we'd rent their rooms. Like when they did the DOA show, the bar got trashed, of course.
Yeah. So
the place that we had for the SNFU show, SNFU were in town, and they had just released If You Swear, You'll Catch No Fish. And the place found out what was happening, and they're like, there's no way we're having 300 punk rock kids in here underage. So they canceled the show. So we ended up found an empty apartment building downtown, and got power into it and lugged in a PA ourselves. And the band played that night for like, we got about 150 kids in there, and wow, there was nothing. There was just a PA, the band, and us. and that's kind of what started my lifelong passion for, you know, sort of just going out and doing it and, you know, not really following the rules, so to speak.
Hell yeah.
You know, and wow, that's kind of where that's been my life, you know, just repetition of that, really.
Let's jump on Mike for a second. Otherwise, he's going to be sitting there listening. We'll spend an hour talking to Ken. No, let's go.
He's interesting. He's got an advantage.
Well, that's true. He is a very interesting guy. But no, I was going to say, because the other interesting thing is the fact that I was never aware that Ken was from Newfoundland. I was never aware that you were actually from England. I just looked at your info, and I was like, when it said Halifax, you initially think, oh, he's from Halifax. I didn't know that. Then you go, no, he's from Halifax.
The original.
The Yorkshire, England.
Yeah.
Which is, have you ever seen, there's a series on, well, it's on Netflix, but it's a series called Last Tango in Halifax. It's an English fun little.
Jackety, yes. I actually recognize a lot of those places.
I was going to say, yeah, because as I was watching it, well, I didn't know this until I read your thing. I go, oh, he's from Halifax, because they call it Halifax over there.
No, there's no H. Halifax.
Halifax. Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
You got to drop the H.
Yeah, exactly.
Halifax.
We talked about that.
So at what point do you, I mean, you come over here, you take jobs from hardworking Canadians. I'm just kidding. No, I'm curious, like, where the accent went. I'm curious where, like, how this all happened. Go. It's all okay. You know.
Okay. I'll try to make it interesting. And I was born there, lived there till I was 3, moved here till I was 10.
Oh,
10
wow.
to 18 was there. So in a weird way, and I find a lot of musicians are kind of the same, that in quote unquote normal life, they don't really like to stick out. So that's why the accent thing came and went. When I got there and I had a Canadian accent, well, the North is a violent and ugly place. It's very tough, and you know, like, everyone's ready to throw down at a moment's notice. You know, your social position is determined by who you have beaten up and who has beaten you up. Like a seed, you know, first seed, second seed, etc. So,
wow.
So, and the other thing is that the Yorkshire accent, you just can't sound smart. I mean, it's charming, but you could be talking about quantum physics and you'll sound dumb.
I want to apologize to our huge Yorkshire audience.
Give us an example.
I'll be right.
Yeah.
But ironically, what became my favorite band after I moved back here, I used to work in a record store because didn't we all?
Yes. Yeah, well, that's what you do, yeah.
Was a band called New Model Army. And they're from Bradford, which is actually, I grew up just outside Bradford.
Wow.
And I actually got their second record called Thunder and Consolation. And again, recognized some of the themes. And I'm like, because the first record looked like a metal record. You know, when you're, oh my God, this is so far off where you started. Misfiling in the store. You're filing, oh, somebody put that in the wrong place, put it in the right place. And I saw New Model Army stuff. And I thought, well, that's weird. New Model Army were actually part of the English Civil War, the original of Oliver Cromwell's gang.
Sure.
We think, hey, we don't like anybody, so we're just going to go to war. But that's interesting. And it looks like, first record looked like a metal record. Like, and then there was a New Music Express review, and I'm like, ah. I picked up the second record for whatever reason and fell in love with it. I've been my favorite band ever since. I never liked the band when I was living pretty much on top of it.
How do you like that?
So then I moved back here into high school, and the same deal. Didn't want to stand out, found a way to lose the accent. And
yeah, but don't chicks dig accents? I mean, I don't know. I'll tell you this Saskatchewan accent. My Saskatchewan accents got me a lot of places, I'll tell you.
Jail.
Jail, yeah.
Yeah, so back and forth. But the cool thing for me was 10 to 18, because that happened as punk rock happened.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
So, like, through the late 70s and very early 80s, I was there, and that was what lit me up about music. Because there was this, and it seemed to happen kind of overnight. It would be like the radio was, you know, BBC One, et cetera, and they're playing like Leo Sayer, and you know, you make it feel like dancing. Stupid shit. And then suddenly there was the Sex Pistols and the Jam and the Stranglers' record, and I was just like, Music's actually something I like.
Yeah.
It was just that crap, and that was which was a step backwards when it came to Canada. First song I heard on the radio, so I remember it. And then I'm going to the land of rock and roll, North America, where it came from. Yay! I turn the radio and I hear, "Babe, I'm leaving." Oh my God! What have I done? I made a dreadful mistake. So that's what put me in the music.
That's funny because, yeah, you bring up a lot of interesting points because we, you know, being a Canadian, I'd be so excited to go to England because of all the music that was going on over there. But it brings up an interesting point. Was it always Toronto that you ended up landing in?
Yeah, well, I mean, officially, I guess my landed emergency status before I became Canadian was Quebec City, but that's just where the boat stopped.
Oh, interesting. Oh, wow.
Yeah, the thing that was cool in my mind as a kid coming to Canada. Canada just had this a young, vibrant,
sure,
forward-looking country. I mean, we're obviously learning horrors lately.
Right, but, right, know, yeah.
That was something I felt connected to Canada that way because England is old as shit.
It is, yeah, I know.
Everything is antique and old and storied history, but wow.
Very, old. Very much so.
Corey. Do you need to put on the subtitles when you watch Peaky Blinders?
Well, they're from the Midlands. That's just
that's different.
Yeah, one guy, I'm like, I don't even know what that accent is, and I'm from there.
Okay,
let's be honest for a second. I think we've got a room full of musicians here. If any of you aren't watching any TV with subtitles, I don't know how you're doing. This
I know.
Everything hates me. I'm like, put on the fucking subtitles. She's like, it's The Price Is Right. I'm like, I don't care. I can't fucking care. The S and T is just gone.
Yeah. Unless you want the TV cranked beyond your comfort level, turn on the subtitles.
Which I'm fine with, but everybody else in the family is too much.
So yeah,
Dad, all the time.
I know.
That's funny. Yeah.
So that brings up some interesting stuff. So, Mike, I assume you picked up the guitar while you were in England then, yeah?
No. I was a super late starter. I didn't start playing until I was almost 17.
Is that right? Wow.
And I think coming from the sort of punk rock, new wave world, picked up guitar, learned three chords, joined a band.
Yes, as you do.
Just as soon as I could, join a band. I mean, I've always been lucky that I have pretty good ears. So I can pick up stuff, you know, quickly and was able to write modest things, but had the, let's face it, we all have some kind of arrogance that makes us think, well, I've discovered E, A, and D. I can do something new.
Yeah, yeah. No one else can do it.
Why?
Yeah.
That was me. I picked it up around 16 or 17 and was in a band almost immediately, you know, playing punk rock and on and on and on it went.
That's funny because we've had Arnold Lanny on here as a guest, you know, and I know you were in the trenches with him in the early days of OLP putting together songs. So how did that work? Like, was he really involved in songwriting and arranging? Well, yeah.
We always tried to be, I guess egalitarian in that, like, just because you're the singer or
hang on, keep going.
the best idea wins, and if you didn't come up with it, suck it up and come up with something better. Or Arnold's pretty hardcore. Like he is a really, or was, I don't know if he still is, but he was a really challenging producer to work with because he just would not let up. You know, aim above the mark to hit the mark was kind of a saying of ours. And I know, like when we finished making Clumsy, we thought we'd made just a dreadful thing because it was always pushing to find, okay, that's a pretty good part. What else you got? What else?
Right.
What else you got? So everything we ended up keeping was kind of not a failure, but the inability to get anything better.
Crazy.
So there was this, at least for me anyway, you know, speaking as a guitar player, because you have, you know, bass and drums, the vocal, and then everything else, which is where guitar kind of has to fill a lot of space.
Yep.
And everything was, well, I didn't come up with anything better. I think maybe there's one thing, the riff from the Birdman, because that wasn't the original riff, was the only thing that was like, okay, I don't really like that. Come up with something else. I'm like, well, I'm an idiot. It's going to take me a minute.
Yeah.
And they just threw it into a chord anyway, and that was the first thing I played. And like, oh, yeah, okay, that's good. We'll keep it. But that's the only time I can remember. Everything else was like, well, I guess it's all right. Let's just keep trying until we don't come up with anything better. So I came away from Clumsy feeling very much like we failed to get our best. Not necessarily healthy, but arguing with the result. You know what I mean? Like we got something that I'm still proud of to this day.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I Corey, do love that.
Got some LP record. A lot. Yeah, it's way ahead of the curve, to be honest. At the time, it was sort of like, oh, we're doing this now? Like, that was the sort of changing of the guard. And,
yeah. I got to give Arn huge credit, even occasionally now. You know, I hear stuff from the first record, Naveed, and just as of now that I'm mixing and engineering and doing awesome, damn, that sounds good.
Yeah.
But now it's so, like, the placement and everything. Like, I had no idea at the time because I was just starting out. But I hear some guys now go, wow, I had no idea. Because it takes about 10 years. Do you guys feel that you ever, when you just finish a record or you just finish recording, you have no sense of it?
No.
Because you're still so enmeshed in the sense memory of playing it.
100%.
Maybe a decade later, you're like, that's a good melody.
Yeah, there's even things that I've been like, oh, well, I'll do better next time, you know, or whatever. You just kind of don't feel that great about something. And then enough time goes past, and you go, what was I so mad at myself for? This is pretty cool, actually. You know, it's like, it's a good problem to have, rather than going, this is awesome, and then 10 years are going, this is terrible. What was I thinking?
Well, dude, of all the great players that I've been lucky enough to meet and play with, none of them think they're great. It's the guys that are not that great are often like, I got this awesome idea. I'm like, no, you don't.
I've come across people who think they're great.
You don't have
they may be idea. Great, but they think they're great.
Exactly.
And Mike, I saw you come through Winnipeg opening for I Mother Earth. So that would have been your first go around, right? Okay, so you guys played downtown.
Mm-hmm. The junkyard.
Junkyard. Aaron, were you there?
I played there.
Yeah, we were together.
Where's the junkyard?
Darren, help me out. I remember we were really into I Mother Earth, and then we were pleasantly surprised at this fucking amazing band, Our Lady Peace, that opened, and you guys crushed it with, you know, that was the first time we'd ever seen you. It was pretty, like, special. Uh-huh. And then at the end of the set, you guys all grabbed your gear and quickly took it off because there was no crew probably at that time. It was, you know, opening slot. But, yeah, that was a pretty epic gig.
That's amazing. I do.
Yeah, the junkyard was owned by the Greens, the same people that owned the zoo, and it was the old A&B Sound building on Portage downtown.
We were in the crowd together, Darren, because I remember we actually stood in the crowd that night. You know, sometimes, you know, you're at the back by the soundboard. That night, I'm like, we're going up front to see these bands. Like, and I remember being right up, you know, kind of close, like, Darren,
was that when I Mother Earth still had the long hair and stuff?
Yeah. They were like very, very lots of radio play, lots of videos, and
kind of some like Jane's Addiction tribally drum stuff. They were like
lots of it. Yeah,
yeah, they had a really good thing going.
Yeah, that was a cool.
Whatever happened to that Edwin kid? Oh, right. Yeah. That's so cool that you play with. That's so cool that you play with Edwin. I love that guy. I haven't seen him in like probably 15 years or something like that. But we always got along really well. Please say hi for me.
I will absolutely.
Yeah, he's the best. He's a star, that kid. He's a star. So he's back doing stuff with I Mother Earth, right?
Well, pre-pandemic, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
They kind of put the brakes on everybody. They did the anniversary of Scenery and Fish.
Good for them.
Great record.
Oh, that's great. It's great when I see old friends get back together. I was telling this story not that long ago when, like, it felt like about 10, 15 years ago, we were all standing around talking about an Edgefest tour. And we went down the list of all the bands there, and I said, dude, every one of those bands is gone right now. Like Moist and Tea Party, those bands had split up in that moment that I was talking about it. I Mother Earth, everybody. So it's kind of interesting now to see the Tea Party, you know, doing their thing, and I Mother Earth doing their thing. It's nice to see a resurgence.
And Moist. I think Moist is around.
Yeah. Moist actually just put out a really good record.
They just put out some music recently. And a lot of the bands are putting out singles now, too, which is an interesting thing.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't part of our life, you know, 25 years ago in the cycle of a record to put out a fucking single without a product. That didn't make any sense, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of us are just kind of cluing in now, you know, sort of 20 years after the fact that, single, that's not a bad idea. You don't need to make a whole freaking record.
Yeah, it's kind of like blue suede shoes, you know, like
it's a weird thing.
That's great. I never thought about that, but you're exactly right. Like when somebody like Elvis would go in, or even when the Rolling Stones did Satisfaction, that was like a single side.
And a lot of the initial Beatles, a lot of the initial Beatles stuff are singles. They're not necessarily
it's the 45 era.
Yeah, it was not LPs per se. Yeah. So now we're coming full circle to this thing of like, here's a song. Like people are putting out like Wolfgang Van Halen's album. I think he's got like six songs just floating out there from an album that's, you know, coming out next month or something like that. I'm like, you know, it's an interesting, I mean, it's the Wild West these days, isn't it? For those of us who've been around doing this for so long, it was like you release a single, a month or so before the album comes out, and the album drops, and then you move on from there. That business model does not fly anymore.
It's gone. Well,
the thing is that the content is now consumed completely different. Like it was so hard when we were all young.
Yeah.
All the way back then, you know, we're reading our stone tablets and stuff. it was so hard to get access to the music you wanted, and it was you had to make a lot of effort. Now it's coming at you like out of a fire hose.
Yeah,
you know, when you're watching people play video games, or you're, you know, TikTok all of like 90 seconds of something, or you know, on and on. And so if it's a whole album, so if I'm 12 years old, I'm probably not capable of listening to 45 minutes of one creative thing.
No. Dude, yeah. I've been sitting down having conversations, like having serious conversations with grown-ups, you know, in this game, saying, "Well, at about the 7-song mark on almost every album, the is a drop off on any sort of streaming, whether it's Apple Music or Spotify or whatever you're listening to. There is a decline in listening numbers by the time they get like halfway through the record, and you're like, so it definitely creates this sort of like." Maybe like Van Halen 2, where there's like 8 songs on the record. You're like, boom, that's the sweet spot. Don't, you know.
Yeah, for me. But as a kid, you look at a record like Generation X, the first Gen X record. I think the whole record is 35 minutes long.
Exactly.
You're just like, but it's fantastic. Every time.
Well, it really does. New bands, like Off. I mean, the last Off record I bought, I think was 16 minutes in total. You know, people wonder, you know, a bunch of 60-year-old punk rockers, and they're popular with the kids. But they're making 30-second songs. I remember the last Thorn, the Big Rex show that I did, not the last one, but one of the last ones. So this would have been about 10 years ago. We were playing at a place that we always played. It was a bar just outside of Toronto in, I'm not going to remember the name of it, Oshawa somewhere. And, you know, it was sort of a standard 500-seat room, you know. We'd played it a bunch of times, and we got there, and it had been a year or so since we'd been there. I remember being told that, you know, our set was at 8. And I was like, what the hell are you talking about? And it was like, no, the live music now, we want it done by 10, because that's when the kids come in. And right. I was like, okay, are the kids watching live music anymore? Anyways, it was sort of happening more and more, and I thought, okay, well, this is the new norm. And we played at 8, but then we went out to do our CD signing, of course, and the you know, they open up the doors, and the old, you know, there's a big rotation of young and different people. But while I was sitting there, the DJ was playing like 30 seconds of each song. And it wasn't like all new house music and stuff that I was unfamiliar with. It was like Summer of 69 by Bryan Adams. And it would like come in, and then there'd be the verse, and you get to the end of the chorus, and then all of a sudden he'd go over and he'd be playing something else. And this went on and on. I went, this sounds like my kids when I'm driving with them, because they get 30 seconds into a song and they hit skip. And that's when I realized, like, it's not what I have learned. Everything from the infrastructure right on down has changed. And part of it is age, but part of it is this huge technology shift that we've had. You know, I mean, everything that I knew as a kid is completely different than what people know as kids nowadays, you know?
It definitely makes you think about the fact that, like, say, side one of 2112, you know, or something like that. It's like, what is that, 20 minutes? I mean, it's like,
you know. I think it all comes down to access. I mean, you have access to all of this material. It'd be like sitting in front of a kid in front of at an ice cream store, and you say, you wouldn't just stick to one, right? You'd want to try them all, right? You have so many to choose from that I think that they just don't have the attention span now, right? You know?
True. Well, I mean, you had a physical playback device that we were all dealing with one or another, whether it's vinyl or CD or whatever. It's like, I want to change a song. I have to get up, stop the CD.
Yeah.
Get out.
I mean, and just the device we're listening, the device they're listening to on it, it's like there's notifications coming out of every like 20 seconds. It's like impossible to stay, give your attention to this thing you're listening to. And then pretty soon you're swiping on something else and you forgot about it. And I do it now too. I can't imagine the kids. You know, they have
an endless catalog of music to check out. If you decide, you know, this song reminds me of something else. So, I want to play. You know, guys are playing each other music. Musicians, we do it all the time. Remember this song? And then you'd be like, you won't listen to like the full 5 minutes or 4 minutes. It's like, no, check it. Eric Singer, our friend Eric Singer, does that to us all the time. Hey, remember the Sweet? Yep. Please, 30 seconds. And
ballroom blitz for 30 seconds.
Remember Slade?
That's the best way to kill time in a van when you're touring. I mean, yeah, we did a van tour as well, and we're dumb. We're like, you know, when you're driving from like Winnipeg to Cold Lake or some awful, you have to do it thing, that's what would absolutely devolve to.
Yeah, you know? 100%.
What about this? And when you listen to it, never the whole song, you're right. Oh, but what about this? And
remember this?
Oh, yeah. It's wonderful, though, because, you know, it connects you to those people really well.
Yeah, yeah,
absolutely. Like, especially somebody like Burroughs. You'd be surprised about Burroughs' tastes. Like, he loves him some Hall & Oates. Full Hall & Oates, though. Sarah Smile. Like, let's
not sure.
Like,
yeah,
any year is whatever it is, but let's go back to the deep cuts.
Well, most of that, you know, most of the stuff like that probably has connections to, you know, roller skating and checking out the ladies. Burroughs seems like the kind of guy. He's so blonde and so tanned and handsome. Damn that guy.
Just if kidding. He wasn't so nice, I'd hate him.
And if he wasn't so talented.
Yeah, he wasn't such a great so drummer and nice and guy. And actually, I hate me.
Yes, I'm sorry. I hate myself. Yeah. Anyway, so... what do you want to get into now? We should probably talk about your time with Thornley, Ken, because I know that you're, from out of nowhere, it was like Ken from The Watchmen is suddenly in.
Maybe before that, we can talk about how you went from, you know, full on Mohawk to returning to your roots. I'm assuming being from
That's
Newfoundland.
True too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's quite a big transition.
You got into the Diddly D music, or how?
I did. Well, you know what happened is it's not the Diddly D so much. I think I was just overexposed to it as a kid. It's just like I like listening to it, but it's just kind of not something I want to play. No. But what I have found is a lot of the Carolina bluegrass stuff. I've been playing a lot of that. You know, I've got myself a nice flat top, and I've been learning the sort of the some of the standards. Crazy guitar stuff. It's just amazing. Mm-hmm.
Since you're playing that so much, you probably don't need that 78 P bass anymore. What do you mean?
78 P bass days. Todd, I mean, everything else bass wise is pretty much gone. I mean, I've got the bass over there that PV made for me when I played on the Leno show, because for me that's a huge highlight. I know that's some big. Of you have done those things as well, and it's a big part of my life, I consider it.
Sure.
And I've got my P bass, and every other bass that I have, I've given to younger players who can't afford them.
That's awesome.
And I've given it to them with the, you know, if ever comes a time where you're not using it anymore.
What about older players who can afford them, but just choose not to? Yeah. But would rather not pay for it. I'll tell my wife I'm going to pay for it.
I'm sure you're pretty well stocked there, my friend.
Yeah, I've got but a 78. That sounds really awesome.
The 78 is you know, I picked it up in Edmonton on one of the very first Watchmen tours. I walked into a music store. I had just bought a black 78 Jazz, nice. Which I used for recording in the trees, and I loved it, and I wanted a sister for it. So I went looking for a P bass, and I happened to be in Edmonton. We went into a store, and this one was there, and I played it in the store. I said, this is great. And
that was somebody from Art Bergman's?
Was it Rich Prisk, maybe?
I'm trying to think which bass player that would have been.
Well, I've got the case in the basement, but when I opened up the case, it said Art Bergman, and then it had the tour name and the year on it. But I'm not sure who the bass player actually was that used it. So
I mean, he's had a number of guys, yeah. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's not why I bought it, but it's become the main bass. It's a Frankenstein. Being a 78, you'd think it's worth something, but it's not. I've the shit out of it.
Yeah, are you going to take it, though, Todd?
I'll take it off your hands.
It still sounds frigging great, yeah.
Well, if it's the Frankenstein, I'll give you $300. It's the best I can. No, but yeah, let's get into that, because I think it's really interesting that this is the funniest thing, because I've had this conversation many times because I play acoustic stuff all the time, and there's a fine line between country music / Americana, you know what I'm saying? Like, in a lot of ways, by today's standards, Tom Petty would have been almost too country to be in Nashville country these days, because it's so much more pop oriented, so much more slick, you know what I mean? Or it can be anyway, you know what I mean? But guys like most of us, you know, we as soon as you sort of take away the drums and the guitars and all that, and it's just you and a guitar, it immediately creates a different vibe entirely, whether it's campfire or, like you say, Carolina bluegrass or just straight up Nashville country. It can be almost anything. Yeah. And you do it so well.
Well, the form that I really enjoy and I've been studying, and after playing, you know, bass and writing songs for radio for so many years, it was really interesting to get into the art of narrative songwriting.
Sure.
Songwriters like Slade Cleaves and Ron Hines, Tom Petty, you know, Tom Petty has all those great catchy pop songs that you can hear at the dance, but he's also like on every album, he's got that one song that just tells a story and you see the characters, you see the places, you see the colors of the curtains, you see all that stuff.
Yeah.
That's the stuff that drew me in. And even on the road with Thornley, I mean, we'd be playing rock and roll. I mean, we were touring in the States with, you know, Nickelback, Three Doors Down and Puddle of Mud and 3 Days Grace. For like a period, for an extensive period.
Any band that had three in their name was on
the exactly. Team. It was the trio of the triumvirate.
The Kingston trio was there.
Most nights at the end of the night, I'd take over the back lounge with a bag of weed and some Nick Drake and Bob Dylan and that stuff. And you know, a few people would come back and smoke dope with me and listen to all this folk music. Meanwhile, in the front of the bus, the frickin' reggae party is raging. But you know, that was kind of what, when I left Thornley, I knew where I was going to go with that. I'd been on the road long enough. As a Canadian musician trying to break in the States, I'd had my fill of it. I couldn't really do it anymore. You know, it didn't matter how good the band was or how much money you had from Canada. If you were trying to get into the States and there's an A&R person there and they've got 10 artists they just signed and 10 artists that came from Canada, where are they going to put their time and energy, you know? The checks they signed, and that I get that. I understand it.
Yeah.
But we did spend so long. I mean, you know, those of us from Canada who've had success in the States, you know how hard that is. And you know how hard it is to do it, you know, without an American, you know, like to go down and play with an American band, you know, to have that American thing is, it's just population and money, really.
Yeah.
I'd had my fill, and I was getting tired of the way that the, you know, for the better part of my commercial record career with record labels, the bands were basically given a check and told to deliver an album. You know, there was some monitoring, but we never had that very heavy, active A&R, you know, sort of, oh, why don't you guys go write with this guy who's hot now, and why don't you do that? And there was a lot more of that happened, and it didn't feel as satisfying to my soul as the other stuff I was doing, for lack of a fucking better way to put it. I know that sounds sappy, but
no, I think that rings true for most people. If you can have the ability to do what you want to do, say what you want to say and put it on tape and hope it connects with somebody, that really is,
yeah,
that's the best thing ever. Yeah.
And, you know, going from, you know, I think the, within a few month period, I went from, you know, doing one of the last shows I did was at Hershey Park, you know, for like 40,000 people in the States. And I found myself 6 months later, after leaving and figuring out what I wanted to do, you know, sitting in a coffee shop with 9 people going,
yeah,
I need to learn how to play guitar and I need to know how to write these songs and I need to know how to work an audience in a brand new way. This isn't volume and it isn't rock and roll. And it was a huge transition. It almost killed me, you know, emotionally, mentally, stably, all that stuff. It was.
Did you find it, like, because I've done this too. I remember years ago, Kevin from the Grapes of Wrath called me and said, hey, we're doing an acoustic thing. It's just like some sort of benefit. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was kind of like, I'm like, sounds great. I'll be there. Remember back when we had normal telephones? Yeah. and then after I hung up the phone, I was like, I've never played an acoustic show in my life. I've never stood on stage with an acoustic guitar. This is like back, this is in the 1900s, just to put it in. but it's definitely that feeling. And the one thing I always tell my friends is when you get up on stage, no matter where you're playing, no one's being rude, but you can hear everything. You know, it's like when you're playing a loud rock and roll, you have no idea that you can hear, hey man, I talked to Jerry at work today. Oh, wait a second, I love this song. You know, like everybody's talking, everybody's kind of interacting. But when you're on stage with an acoustic guitar and it's just you and your voice, it's like you hear the hum of just everybody talking. Thankfully, sometimes if you're playing to 9 people, it's a little quieter.
Well, it's an interesting point, and I won't go too far into it, but I've noticed that there are certain places that have an audience that is built for that.
Yes.
And like I was hired to do Merlefest, you know, which is a pretty big bluegrass Americana festival, one of the biggest in the States. And I had an afternoon spot, and the guy who hired me to play it, when I kind of got down there and saw what was happening, I was like, you saw me in Toronto at a conference and you hired me. I said, like, I'm a storyteller and a songwriter. I said, there's 18,000 people out there. You want me to play for 45 minutes? I said, like, I'm cool with it, but like, what's, you know, I said, like, what the fuck am I in for? And he said, don't worry. He said, that's why I brought you down. He said, you deserve these type of audiences. And I went out and 18,000 people, and I went out with my acoustic guitar and I told my stories and I sang my songs. And it was like playing to a theater of 35 people and with perfect sound. It was amazing. It was so much different than like when I found myself in North Bay on a Saturday night playing for 300 drunk college students.
Sure.
Doing my solo Leonard Cohen shit. You know, they didn't get it. So yeah, having the right audience is a huge key. But those audiences are very fickle and they're pretty tight as well. I haven't found a lot of them in Canada. Like, I haven't found a lot of pockets in Canada the same way I have in the US. I wish there was more up here.
So are you saying they were accepting of you, or you had to, it was tough?
They loved it. It was great. The guy who booked the show, I mean, he knows what he's doing. And it was just, I couldn't believe, you know, James Taylor was, you know, I played at 4. James Taylor was on at 7.
Amazing. I
think Fleck was on right after me. It was just you know, these are huge things. And, you know, coming from Canada where we don't have that marketplace and that sort of acceptance, it did kind of freak me out a bit.
Well, we have to have had some kind of, I mean, Joni Mitchell and Gordon Lightfoot, all these people came from Canada. So
you know, you can go down to the States and find those audiences. And then when you become, you know, when you come back to play Massey Hall, yes, you can hear a fucking pin drop.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's hard to find
Gordon Lightfoot. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. You know, but what you said about the everybody hearing everything too, that's the other scary fucking thing. You know, I mean, you're finger picking and it's just your strings and your voice. Oh man, you make mistakes or you start to feed back or lose control.
Well, I've never made mistakes.
It's a nightmare.
Mistakes? What mistakes?
Yeah, there's more pressure when it's just you and your guitar.
Yeah.
Because every wrong note is pretty noticeable to everyone.
Yeah,
or your voice cracks,
or you are a bit nervous. Once you do make a mistake, you know, and you start, your voice starts to quiver, and
you know.
you really deliver that style of music really authentically.
Yeah, you do. Yeah,
and I'm wondering if you're actually accepted by the Canadian Country Music
Association.
No, I didn't think so. That's why I asked, because it's,
they won't have
that's not authentic, but it's a, what you're doing is, it reminds me of, like, you know, like the Merles and the Willies, and then of course Steve Earle kind of dudes, and and the storytelling, and it's not so much about you jumping around in a video and, you know, and saying, look at me, I'm awesome. It's just about it's just about kind of being awesome through authenticity, you know.
I think you should try that, Ken.
Well,
done a lot of he was just about to debut the video for me. I'm awesome. That's the new single. Yeah, that's the
new single. I'm awesome. Yeah. No, it has been a very rewarding on a totally different level. It's a different thing. I can't even describe it. I mean, it's just, you know what it's like when you find a new audience, regardless of the size of the audience, but when you find an appreciative audience who really gets what you're doing and you've worked really hard to do something that is, you know, authentic is a word I keep using, not because I'm trying to be authentic, but just because I'm trying to be me.
Yeah.
You know, there's already Willie Nelsons, there's already Steve Earles, there's already Hank Williams. All these people have already been. I don't want to be any of that. And that's what I didn't like about the record industry. You know, when it started getting into, well, this is cool now, can you be more like? I'm like, no, sorry, that's not. I mean, if I was that, yeah, fine, but I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, you end off with a very small niche when you do those things. And it's really rewarding, you know, regardless of the size and stuff. I feel good at 52 years old to still be able to feed my kids every night and pay the bills and just play music. You know, it's
pretty at the end of Johnny Cash's life though. You know, I mean, he was one of those guys, and so many of the Merles and the, you know, those guys, they sort of, like, if you weren't playing the Nashville game, and I think that goes for music in general, if you're not playing whatever the game is in whichever term factor there is, you're sort of like left out in the cold. So guys like Johnny Cash had to completely reinvent himself by going completely back to where he started, which was just an acoustic guitar and his voice. And then he sort of reestablished himself as a legend rather than, you know, playing at, like, you know, the county fair Nothing that there's anything wrong with playing the county fair. The county fair pays great, by the way.
So. Yeah, no, I'm any county fair is give me a call.
So, Mike, when like say guys like Ken who move into things like Thornley and Big Rack and doing his own music, you decide to kind of move into more of a behind the scenes kind of world, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I guess when after I left OLP, it was very much, well, what now? It's been a decade making records and touring, mm-hmm. and that doesn't come with a whole lot of transferable skills, as we all know.
Yeah, right.
So, but I always did enjoy the. We were talking about earlier. I don't remember if it was before we went on air or not, but the whole like you had to put down the boombox in the room and catch the magic.
Yes,
and if. I loved working with young bands. I mean, I worked with a bunch of them, bands like Goodbye Honolulu and Blurred Medic, and watching them when you decide them, okay, we're going to do the bridge and we're going to go to a little thing I call the minor six. Mm. And you're going to think I know what the fuck I'm talking about. You're going to light up, because it's easy for, you know, the longer you do this, you see the patterns, you know the tricks, you know the stuff, but when you see the lights go on in younger players.
Sure.
That's so fucking cool. It's like, well, yeah, it is. I kind of forgot, but when you see it in them, that's what I loved, and that's what getting back into the studio to work with, especially younger bands, that was what was, you know, driving me.
So I always wonder, for guys like yourself, do you miss the guitar? Like, do you miss getting up in front of people and playing, or is that... As that's happened, I know you've done it several times.
He redoes the guitar on every record that he makes. He doesn't. Well, that,
there you go. There you go.
That whole, I got an idea, guys. I'm just gonna. I guess the thing for me, yeah, of course, anybody that has played live, especially to an appreciative audience, if you could put that in a pill, it would make the track look like decaf coffee. you know when you're on a big stage and you're playing a song that people love, whether it's yours or you're just a part of it, and that wave comes back at you. Like, there is no drug better. I've not tried that many drugs, but that one is it's unbelievable. So of course I'll miss that to a degree. But the other 22 hours, don't miss those.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah.
No, never. No, I was lucky. You were talking about tour managers. I only missed one flight. Never got oil spotted. Any confessions for that? Anybody oil spotted? Anybody?
I think we've all missed once. Yeah.
Oh, really? What, you were oil spotted, Fitzy? How? Oh, yeah. Oil spotted, our folks in Wisconsin watching, the oil spotting is when if you miss the bus call or the van call or whatever, that van just leaves without you. Whether on purpose, one time we had a sound guy where this happens, this is a classic, where the bus pulls over in the middle of the night, guys go inside to get, you know, snacks or go to the bathroom or whatever, and we just all get back on the bus, drive away, and then like sometime later, a truck pulls up beside us where our sound guy's waving at us like... This is pre-cell phones. This is, yes, I don't even, probably like late 80s, early 90s. So we're like, oh my God, you know, because it's when the bus driver comes on and goes, are we a bus? That means, is everybody on the bus? Yeah. But these things do happen. But being oil spotted.
You're asking incredibly irresponsible people to take responsibility for the fact that everybody's there. I mean, you're supposed to put your laminate on the bus driver's seat.
That's the etiquette, but yeah.
Again, that's responsible people.
True.
Bands, maybe even our responsible crew, on the other hand.
Right.
Perhaps not. So, yes. I mean, but
I got a good one for you guys. So have you guys ever had the one where you're cruising down the road and the bus driver makes an announcement that, you know, we're going to stop and do laundry at, you know, like in 2 hours, we're going to pull over, everyone's going to get off, take all their shit, go in and wash it. So we do that. We pull over. Everyone gets off. Grab all the suitcases. Grab everything. And apparently, the bus driver never got paid.
Oh.
And he bolted.
Oh.
And we're stuck in a freaking truck stop with all our shit.
But
I can't mention what tour it was. But
that's great. That's brilliant. Oh. It's laundry, so that means everybody's got to take your shit and get off the bus.
Not,
brilliant.
Not to mention that was actually the end of the tour too.
Which tour was this?
I can't say.
Can't. It was Tuke, wasn't it?
It was last week, guys. Yeah. I'm funny, man.
That was brutal, though.
I remember there was a band from L.A.
And we were on the East Coast.
That I worked with years ago, and they had a similar horrifying story too. Their bus driver kicked them off when they were in, I think it was Boston, with all of their gear because he hadn't been paid. And when they finally called management, management said, "Well, the label's dropped you. The album is done." And they were stuck on the other side of America with all their gear.
Oh
and,
my god!
Now it's just on the side of a friggin' road.
Oh my god!
Yeah, it's a good industry.
No, I don't miss that stuff.
Yeah, yeah, the music business, right? It's a dream. It's a dream factory. We live in a dream factory. Rainbows and.
Yeah. And so, sorry, Mike. I wanted to squeeze one more question for you. I was reading about how you put together a mobile recording facility early on.
Terrible idea.
And I was pretty interested in how that came to be. Were you interested in production at that point, or was
that was my early like? Okay, I'm also kind of a. I like to fix things and make things and that. And I was like, okay, live recordings are kind of fun. Let's try that. So I built it around a 001 rig, and it was, I could pull, I think, 18 or 20 tracks in by my everything and just tie into a monitor desk and record things. And it was okay. And then I was like, yeah, but that means I'm here first and leaving last. So we're not. I didn't think this through. But ironically, coincidentally, right pre-COVID, that was what I'd been doing. A company that I'm on the board of an advisory board for called Official Community, they specialize in bundling, and they deal with quote unquote heritage artists. So I'd spent most of the previous year mixing Mark Knopfler. I would just get USB keys of his 11-piece band.
Wow.
Who are profoundly multi-instrumental, so 97 channels off stage. Here's a USB key with 128 gigs of 2 hours of Mark Knopfler.
Wow.
I would get through them, and I would have to mix a show a day.
Wow.
So for templates.
Crazy.
But I ended up, 20 years later, that's where I was. And right pre-COVID, you mentioned James Taylor. Ken, that was one of the next one was the James Taylor tour, Jackson Browne. I think Sarah McLachlan was on deck, and then COVID, so no.
Wow,
what a drag.
Jesus.
But I can tell you, and with all the love in the world, nobody needs to hear 87 Mark Knopfler shows.
Man, Mark Knopfler, he was such a musical guitarist and musician, and Dire Straits, they were so, epic. But his singing just kind of brought it all crashing in my opinion, because it didn't match the beauty of every other instrument and ability. It's just like, okay, someone's got to sing. How about, I guess I'll sing,
Yeah, I guess you're right. But he's developed into such a great songwriter. All of his, his film stuff is amazing.
Oh, beautiful.
It's definitely where I come from, but he's one of the people that can have fucking as a middle name. Any criticism falls by the wayside.
There is a street in Vegas named after him. There's a bunch of guitar players in one street, but he is of the five streets. They picked Mark Knopfler as one of the names. So that is pretty epic.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Another street that nobody can spell.
I live off of CC DeVille Avenue. Let's talk about the current project now, because I know that this is the reason that people are like, why would you bring these two guys from two separate things in and make them sit? Because we're punishing people now. We're making each other listen to each other's careers. But no, because Ken has a project that Mike was, obviously a huge part of. So I'm really curious to know how this all came about. It sounds great what I've heard of it. I've only heard the Mad World track and a couple others, but it would sound really cool. And what a cool idea.
Cool. Well, I'm glad you like what you heard. It's a bit of a story here. I got to try and truncate it. Sorry, my Newfoundland nature might take over. I'll try not. So when COVID hit, I had already been in isolation for a year. Six or seven years ago, my wife was diagnosed with MS. Mm. It got progressive fairly rapidly. And as of 3 years ago, she had lost her ability to walk and the use of one of her arms. And she went in for a stem cell bone marrow transplant, which meant we had to relocate to Ottawa for a year. And the transplant took, I think she was in a hospital bed for 70 odd days. And then there's a 2-year recovery. Wow. And during the first year of the recovery, we had to live in an isolation bubble, which everybody's doing now. So during that time, I was in Ottawa, and I set up a small home studio at the place that I was living while she was in hospital. And being isolated really sort of made me wonder how I can still work with people and keep into the world. And I came up with a few sort of strategies that helped me. And when COVID hit, I started broadcasting live on Wednesday nights just for fun, this thing I do called Whiskey Wednesday. And I was really enjoying that. So I sort of offered all the musicians out there, I said, I know everybody's having a hard time now, you're all locked up at home. So anybody who's has a home studio or is interested in putting one together, get a hold of me and let's make a record together. I want to record 13 songs, simple acoustic tracks. And I thought there'd be maybe 4 or 5 people. I ended up having almost 70 people try and work on the record, of which 45 made it on. And nobody heard what anybody else was doing. I sent everybody the same a track of me playing acoustic guitar and vocal with a click track. Wow. And said, you know, put in whatever you want, fiddles, mandolins, fucking electric guitars, I don't care. And Mike reached out really early on and said, hey, Ken, this is going to be a massive mixing and editing project. You know, can I offer my services? And I said, absolutely. My wife was doing good then. She was walking, like she could get up out of bed with a walker and go to the bathroom and get a drink of water and that stuff. So I had some independence. So I started this project. And about 2 months into the project, we were about 60 or 70% of the way through getting everything back from everybody. And I had the arrangements knocked in and, you know, sort of me and Mike had been back and forthing on the bass and drums. And, you know, putting that foundation together when people aren't hearing each other was a challenge. And then my wife, one of the effects of her treatment was possibility of severe osteoporosis. And we didn't know that. And she ended off with that. And one day she was just standing up, and as she stood, her hip exploded. And she had to go in. Yeah, so ambulance came off to major surgery. Then 2 days after the surgery, they said she should go to a rehab, but all the rehabs were closed, so they sent her home. So I had a wife that's already 2 years bedridden, you know, just coming out of all this shit, now with a broken hip and an open wound. And I had to, you know, I set up a hospital room in the house for her. So we got the lifts and the bed and the, you know, everything you need in a hospital room. And I got it all in. And I called Mike and I said, Mike, I said, we're really close on everything. I'm really, you know, like at this point, I'd been getting stuff, listening to it, putting it in context, then sending it to Mike and discussing. And we had, like I say, about 60 or 70% of it done. And I said to Mike, I said, I'm kind of out. I said, I don't know how long my wife is going to be out, but like I'm constant, like she lives at home with me and I don't know how much time I have, at least for the next few months. And Mike just kind of stepped up and said, just send me everything. He said, everybody knows what they need to do. Just keep sending it. So every couple of days, I'd look at my email and I'd see what new tracks I'd have. And I'd drop them in and line them up to make sure bit rates and all that stuff were okay, which most of them were. And then I'd kind of, if there was something that I really didn't want in a part, I'd cut it out and then resample it and send it to Mike. Come the end of the year, I get a message from Mike. I mean, I've been taking care of my wife and having this hell of a year and trying to get back on the go and doing other things as well, trying to just stay alive. And then Mike said, I think the record's mixed. And I was like, so all of a sudden I start getting these tracks and it's the weirdest thing because I had heard like from me and my acoustic to an almost finished track. And then all of a sudden I get a track that's not just mixed and finished, but also has all this extra like keyboards and organs and flutes that are not flutes. There was no flutes on it, but whistles. All this shit that I hadn't heard in context. And I can't, you know, I mean, I don't like saying it because he's right there and I don't want to make his head explode. But I've been talking about it so much. I mean, you know, I even called Mike in December. I said, I think this record should be called like Tizzard Turner or something, like you've done so much. And he said, well, he said, you know, it was, you chose them, you directed them, you arranged them, you sang them, you brought the musicians together. He said, it's a Ken Tizzard record, but then he offered his appreciation. But with the situation being the way it was this last year for me, the record would have crumbled out the gate, so to speak. But with Mike stepping up the way he did, it actually, it turns out to be a smashing listen, I think. I'm really, really happy. Wow. And I'm really happy with everybody on it. I mean, we've got, you know, Daniel Adair sending 31 tracks of drums to a musician who's never played with a band before, who has a drum kit set up in their garage with two microphones. And, you know, we have this incredible array of people, professionals and non-professionals, and everybody is in, and nobody was directed. It was like, just send us what you do. Mm. And it somehow sounds cohesive. And I don't know how Mike did that. It's just, it sounds.
I'm going to put this out there. Take it for what it is. Tizard Turner Overdrive.
Genius, clearly.
Nice one.
You'll
nice.
Be sued in 5 seconds. Trust
exactly.
me.
Exactly.
But Randy, no,
not really. That, yeah, exactly. That's such an amazing story, dude. Like that's just.
It really is.
I mean, it's funny because during the course of COVID, you know, having to deal with the way people have had to deal with, just you know, being in perfect health but being locked in. You're having to deal with something, you know, and indirectly and directly, your wife having to deal with something so serious and so severe. That's just, I mean, I just think the world of you guys for, and Mike as well, for Mike stepping up and really kind of giving his all to that project. I really, you know, God bless.
There's so much of that goodwill involved in this project. And I mean, and for me, the, you know, the last 5 years for me have been tough. I've managed to still go out and do Watchmen shows. I do whatever festival shows I can and stuff, but I can't be touring the way that I want because my wife needs me home. And I'm still managing to, you know, I actually have a few sort of, like, I don't have a Patreon account or anything like that, but I mean, I actually have people that send me money every month and they're like, I've been listening to your music for 25 years. I know you're having a hard time. You know, I hope this helps. And it adds up, you know, it helps to, helps with everything, you know. It helps with everything.
Can we have their email addresses, please?
Yeah. Are they watching?
Are they watching? Yeah,
I hope they're watching.
It really should be. Yeah.
No, it's been amazing.
How is your wife doing now?
Yeah, how's she doing?
She's doing well. She's still like today. You know, I'm with her in the mornings. You know, sort of I get up and I have my coffee and I help her with her exercises. And then I help her out of bed into her wheelchair. Mm. Now that the weather is a little better, I can wheel her in the backyard. So she sits, she sits in the backyard and I sit on my computer next to her with my guitar. I've got a guitar and a computer in the kitchen. Mm. And, you know, she's in the wheelchair most of the day. And then about 6 or 7 o'clock, she goes back to bed. But I spend all my time with her. I'm just, my studio, like I say, the studio is above the room, so she's in the room below me. So I'm either here in the studio or I'm on the couch downstairs playing guitar and on the computer working. Luckily with technology and also with the adaptability that everybody is part of now because of COVID, you can actually sort of somewhat manage an online career right now if you have the time to do it. If you say that's your job, you know, I mean, I do one broadcast a week, which means, you know, I have to prepare, you know, 15 acoustic songs and a bunch of stories every Wednesday for the people that show up. And I play, you know, I try and add new songs every week. It's everything from The Cure to John Prine. And that's kind of a lot of work to put that shit together and then edit it into a podcast and edit it into simpler videos for YouTube. I do everything. And that's,
Have you looked into OnlyFans? Sorry.
Start posting pictures well with my vigorous masturbation schedule, but
no, it really.
There it is. Yeah, everybody that's now. Listening, that's, check it out.
All together now. There, that's the project.
Cool
yeah.
project. Oh, your mic's
still muted. Brent Fitz is muted.
Sorry, Brent.
No, I was just saying. No. It's on Spotify, of course. I just go there because it's the quickest. But of course, I'm sure it's everywhere else. But that's what's great is it's already there. And
is it available in compact disc?
No. Okay. I passed on the CD this time. But I'm picking up vinyl tomorrow morning.
Oh, cool!
Awesome. So I'm excited for that. Yeah,
really cool.
Yeah, we
is that going to be available online?
Yep. Yeah, the vinyls. I think I only did 300 copies. It's a short run, you know. I'm. That's kind of manageable for me, and it makes it available to the collectors and the people that really want it. I think I've sold almost 200 of them already, but you know, there's some around. Yeah,
that's fantastic. Yeah. I really hope that, you know, I'm always paying attention to you. One thing I'll always say about Ken is it always seems like he has that sort of hustle kind of character to it. You're always doing something, and I always appreciated that about you, even though clearly you've not been able to be as active as you'd like to be as far as being out and about, even prior to the pandemic. I'm always impressed that you've managed to. Now hearing this story, I'm like, wow, I can't believe you've been able to make any of this work. Thank God for people like Mike Turner there to kind of help us along.
Well, let's face it, it's slightly self-motivated as well because I was bored as hell. I played guitar work for some folks. I played guitar for a band from China.
Wow.
Queen C. Big Shark, I think they were called. A friend of mine who's a producer said they're the Blondie of Beijing. Like, not really, but it is a girl singer, so whatever. But, you guys do the session thing more than I'm ever going to do it. But it's kind of amazing and antithetical to what I used to love about music. Here's a bunch of files, do a bunch of guitar. No one will. Oh, what was that you just played? No, you won't because you're alone completely.
Right.
Because I find that a little weird. But also, you know, I'm far enough along in doing what I do and my inability, utter and complete, to facilitate things. I can only do one thing. I do it very well. I do me. Mm. And for better or worse, I sound like me. Like when
a lot of people don't do that.
Like, can you sound like so-and-so? Well, I can try, but I gotta warn you. It's gonna end up sounding like me playing that guy's parts. And that's not a boast. Like, I really don't have a lot of facility. The most difficult thing I do in this life is music.
Yeah.
You know, I was an industrial mechanic by trade. I went through school for English and classical studies. Academia comes fairly easy. Music's hard, but that's what I want. So, doing the project with Ken, when I saw it was presented, I thought, that's kind of fascinating. Well, mainly, I think I was drawn by the fact you put Driver 8 on. Like, I love early REM.
Yeah.
I'll just do something. I think I did some vocals. And
it's all harmonies, yeah.
You know, the Mad World cover. Mm-hmm. I didn't know Danny Day was doing it, but I'm like, I love that first Tears for Fears record. I remember when that came.
Great record. Out, brilliant. The Hurting. Amazing. Like,
this blew everybody's mind. When the first time I heard Change, I think it was on a like a white label import club or something, and they're like, what is that noise? That's a marimba. What is it doing here? but you know what I mean? There was that freshness. So I was like drawn to the material, and it was interesting because there's other stuff that I obviously wouldn't have known coming from the background of me, but the King is Gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. Awesome.
So cool.
You know, so, I think that's one of the most notable things I've ever heard anybody say is that, you know, all this other stuff, whatever, but music is hard. It says so much about, like, you know.
That's why we're here.
I know. It's like, it's that whole thing of, like, bringing up Mark Knopfler, you know, money for nothing and your chicks for free. It's like, it's really not like that at all. I mean, right. If you're lucky enough to get into a position where you're getting any money at all, then you're, you know, it's a rarity, but yeah. Yeah,
but it is hilarious. But it was super interesting doing the project and just having stuff come in. And like Ken was saying, the distance between, you know, Dan Adair's tracks. Wow,
true. I mean,
great player, clearly. And you know, it's like, and I'm scrolling through the files, dragging them into a session. Like, Coles, yep, those are going to be good sounding. You know, Coles 4038 on the room. I'm like, so you have a room that merits Coles mics? Okay, cool. This is
right.
And others, it's like, there's four stereo pairs that came out of a MIDI drum brain. Oh, dear.
Ken, we've got some people asking where they can go if they wanted to order, and I pulled up your website. Is that where I should direct them to go?
Yeah, please.
So anybody watching, you know, wants to go and check this out and, you know, pre-order the vinyl if there's any left, by all means, go ahead and do so.
And I got it in about 3 seconds on Apple Music.
Bam!
There you go.
Easy. They pay better than Spotify.
That's awesome. That's very exciting. I know. I really hope that this does something to kind of get some people kind of on board for you.
I don't know, man. I don't know. I talk to my wife about it all the time, and you know, because I was talking to her yesterday, I was having that sort of that bottoming out thing that happens after you know, after you release a record, sort of a couple days or a week later, you know.
Yeah.
But it was a little worse this time because it was like, I didn't shake any hands. I didn't give anybody a hug. I didn't sign any CDs. People didn't hear the songs live. Like, they're getting the album, and I'm getting nice comments, but what? And it was just kind of bottoming me out. But then my wife said, you know, she said, Ken, she said, that's not what this record's about anyways. And she said, it's really not about what you're doing anymore. She said, do you like the record? I said, yeah.
said, do you like the people you worked with? I said, this has been one of the most amazing musical experiences and social experiences of my life. And she said, and the music sounds good. She said, so if nobody buys it, you've already succeeded. And I kind of like, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's still nice when people buy it.
You married a very wise woman. That's actually a really nice.
Yeah, she's been great.
We should all look at it that way, really. It's like, if it's the record you wanted to make and all that kind of stuff, and you feel good about it, then it's a success before anybody buys one copy.
Absolutely, absolutely.
He tells himself.
Yeah.
That was something Arne taught us in the beginning, because obviously Arne had been sort of through the ringer. And I love his story and the karmic side of it. You know, he was through the ringer with Sheriff. And
yeah.
One song that he loved, because he wrote it for his wife Val, was When I'm With You.
Yep. Yes.
And he bought it back.
Yeah.
So the album had been deleted. Like, it was over, done, dead, buried. He's just like, yeah, but I just don't want that song to be owned by somebody else. And that was before it did its own thing. Starting in Vegas, actually. Vegas Arena, somewhere down there. And so he owned all of the publishing when it blew up. So karmically, it came around. But his thing telling us, having been through the ringer and come out the other side of it like that, he's like, guys, getting a record deal is easy. Making a record is hard. Making it succeed, even harder. The only thing you can guarantee is if you like it or not when it's done. Mm-hmm. So if you try to make a record, Ken mentioned earlier, that sounds like so-and-so or is such-and-such because you think it's going to succeed, even if you get that right and you make that simulacrum that's going to do well because it sounds just like something else, maybe your A&R guy got fired before the record came out and the next A&R guy doesn't want anybody else's piss stains on success, so your record just never comes out.
Yeah. There's seen that a lot.
There's 100 ways for a record to die, and maybe half a way for it to have a chance. So the only thing you can guarantee is, I like this record.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if that's all you get, I mean, that's better than nothing.
It is.
Mm-hmm. So he's going to push us to do that with Naveed. If make a record you like, and do the thing we need to do. And that's why that clanky snare, which I'm sure engineers everywhere went, what the fuck is that? we auditioned really good snares. Like I remember having the day where we sat there and it's like, yeah, that 8 or 9 snares from Craig at Call Audio, and trying all these snares, and we just numbered them. We didn't say what they were. It's like expensive Brady Australian hardwood frou-frou. And I think it was an old Rogers power tone. So it's just plank, and we're like,
oh. Yeah.
I don't know why. But whatever it was when we said that, and then, you know, that was, we kept that kind
of... It had a lot of character. That snare drum sound had a lot of character. It definitely popped out of those records, out of those radio speakers when I first heard it, that's for sure.
Yeah, it sure was hard to pick a charger on it sometimes.
Because it still had, it had merit today, because you look back and you go, well, that was an interesting sounding record, because it had that cool snare drum.
Yeah,
exactly. I always liked that. It didn't sound like the other stuff on the radio. Pretty cool.
Yeah. You know, it was trying to make a record we like.
Exactly.
So the moral of the story is do what you love, right? I mean, and it's a labor of love. So, I mean, and on that note, I mean, this is, I guess, you know, we've kept you guys for a long time, and we wanted to tell everybody that, you know, if you want to go check out, you know, Ken's stuff, kentizzard.com. You guys, it's been great having you on the show. It's been fantastic.
Amazing.
We couldn't leave today. Actually, and it was brought to my attention, and we should have maybe talked about it in the beginning, but we were waiting for Fitzy. You know, obviously a lot of stuff going around with Canada and the 215, you know, everything that happened out in Vancouver, surrounding area, BC, with the Kamloops. With the residential schools. I mean, you know, we've talked a lot. We've acknowledged the Humboldt crash and whatnot. And it's been one of those things that's been a dark day for Canada. So we joke a lot and, you know, we talk about hockey and things, but sometimes miss over the important social aspects. But yes, we had to acknowledge that just because obviously that was something that needs to be mentioned, you know, and needs to be acknowledged. So further to that, we are going to now go enter into the Jets versus Montreal playoffs and tune in next week to find out if I will be winning or losing that bet. So,
next week.
You never Ken, you're from Newfoundland. What's a good bet that I can have with my friend out in Newfoundland on this series? He's a Montreal fan and I'm a Winnipeg fan, and we want to make this wager a little bit interesting. What's an embarrassing thing I can have him do out in Newfoundland that we can post on the show?
There's not much embarrassing stuff you can make a Newfoundlander do, to be perfectly honest.
they've already done it all, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's really I really can't think of anything. If I had some time to prepare something, I might be able to come up with it. But no, I Newfoundlander
is embarrassing. All right. Well, if anybody listening has an idea, leave it in the comments, and we'll be sure.
And who's your Newfoundland friend going for?
He's Montreal. Yeah,
That's the Newfoundland thing. That's the Newfoundland thing for sure. Yeah.
I got a good thing. I got a good thing, Darren.
What's that?
He has to, in a video, in his skiffies or a speedo or whatever, sing the Took Talk theme song and then do the 6:30 in Newfoundland line at the end.
Newfoundland. Yes. Okay. There it is.
You guys do that on the podcast too. You add Newfoundland in. That's so friggin' Canadian. Yeah. That's just great.
I think that's it. He's probably watching right now going, oh shit. But yeah, okay, that's it.
It's skimmies.
And I mean, there's not many embarrassing things that I haven't done either. So, I mean, you know, pretty much real. I think actually Fitzy.
What is embarrassing nowadays? I don't even
know. I don't know.
Well, you know,
that, right?
Todd and Ken, you can actually both relate to the fact that we are so lucky to have had a lot of our career that would have been the embarrassing part in the 90s before cell phone video and before YouTube.
Thank God. Thank God.
Word. Yeah. Word, brother. Word. Yeah, I always think that. It's like, you know, there's enough. Well, there's enough that went on fashion-wise that you have to kind of live with that exists in photos and videos. I can tell you,
because of me in the 80s, you don't know.
But you guys must get that all the time, too, right? You get that alert. It's like so-and-so tagged you in a photo, and it's like, oh, shit. You know, what am I doing?
High school friends, yeah.
There was some catastrophic facial hair on my part, so I can't the bonsai. I'm just getting it right. No, it's ridiculous.
That's fantastic. Well, guys, it's been a blast. And again, you know, thank you so much. And it's been great. And Ken, you know, I'm sure I speak on behalf of everybody watching and all of us here. You know, wish your wife the best and, you know, just inspiration, you know, to everybody watching, you know, that, you know, you're able to do your thing and stay home with her and care for her. That's been fantastic. So wish you guys all the best. And even more so, appreciate your time being with us here today, because we know you obviously got a lot to do. So.
Thanks for having us. I mean, and it's nice to see Mike again. It's really nice to meet all of you that I haven't met before. And those that I have, it's nice to reconnect.
Absolutely.
Thanks again for having us on. This project is a bit of a thing that happened, you know, just from the heart. And I appreciate any time that anybody has for it. So and it's cool to chat with everybody, too. I'm bored as fuck here.
I hear you.
We could finish the broadcast. We'll just hang out.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to. Stick around.
All right, guys. Thanks, everybody. Right, and we will see you next Tuesday.
Okay.
Bye, guys.
Cheers. Bye.